There are moments in history where the official story doesn't just bend the truth, it quietly replaces it. Not with lies, but with silence. And one of those moments happened right here, when America's own rulebook was rewritten behind locked doors. By the end of this video, you'll see how the Constitution of the United States, the document we treat like scripture, was born out of a meeting that technically broke the law. And how that one decision shaped every power struggle we're still living through today. It's Philadelphia, June 1787. Rain slicks the cobblestones outside the Pennsylvania State House. Pamphlets soaked and stuck to the walls read, "Save the Union, amend the Articles." Most citizens think that's exactly what's happening inside. A little paperwork, some tweaks to the Articles of Confederation, the young nation's first constitution. But inside, something else is unfolding. A man stands in the hallway outside the chamber door, rain dripping from his coat. He's late. He's nervous. Through the thick wood, he hears voices. Madison, Hamilton, Morris, already deep in debate. They were sent to fix the Articles. But the whispers he's heard say otherwise. Yesterday, someone slipped him a note, scrawled in haste. They're not fixing it. They're starting over. His hand lingers on the brass doorknob. He knows that if he walks in, he's no longer there to represent his state. He's part of something much bigger, maybe noble, maybe treasonous. The smell of wet parchment and candle wax leaks through the cracks. Inside, Washington presides in silence. No one's saying amendments anymore. They're saying Constitution, a new one, a total rewrite. He turns the knob, the heavy door shuts behind him with a sound that could have been thunder. Outside, the city keeps moving, unaware that in that single moment, the first government of the United States quietly ended. No battles, no blood, just a handful of men who decided that the law they'd sworn to defend wasn't good enough. Over the next 4 months, those doors would stay locked, windows nailed shut, press banned, every delegate sworn to secrecy. By the time the public found out what had happened, it was already done. And what started that summer in Philadelphia didn't just rewrite America, it reprogrammed how power itself would work, from the founding era to the world we live in right now. So tonight, we're going back to that room, to the rain, the whispers, and the silence that built an empire. Because the world outside thought they were fixing the system, but inside that room, they were building a new one. Hey folks, before we dive deeper, quick favor please. If you want more stories like this, the kind that slip through the cracks and barely survive the algorithm, please help me by subscribing. No fluff, no sponsors, just weird truths most channels won't touch. All right, back into it. They told us it was just a handoff, a clean, orderly transition from one form of government to another. But it wasn't. It was a bait and switch. And the receipts are hiding in plain sight. And look, I love this country. I served in her military. I believe in what she was supposed to be. Freedom, transparency, the right to question those in charge. But loving something means telling the truth about it, even when that truth is uncomfortable. And the truth is, the Constitution, the document that defines every lever of power in our government, wasn't born the way we were taught. It wasn't passed with full consensus. It wasn't legal under the existing laws. It wasn't even what the states asked for. Congress gave strict instructions: fix the existing system, tweak the Articles of Confederation. That's it. But when the delegates walked into the room in 1787, they locked the doors, tossed the articles, and started over from scratch. They changed the rules of ratification. They ignored the requirement for unanimous consent. They operated in total secrecy. The press was banned. the windows were nailed shut, and the delegates swore oaths to never speak of what went on inside. That's not speculation. It's not even controversial. It's documented in the letters, in the missing journals, in the anti-federalist papers they don't teach you in school. Now, maybe they thought they were doing the right thing. The country was cracking. States were threatening to break away. There were rumors of another war. So they acted outside the law to write a new one. And it worked. What they created has lasted more than two centuries. But it also lit the fuse for something they may never have intended. A federal machine with tentacles in every aspect of life, able to surveil its own citizens, confiscate property, tax generations not yet born, and bankroll conflicts without asking the people footing the bill. All of it constitutional, because technically it is. Most Americans never hear this part of the story. Not in school, not in 4th of July speeches, not in the "and then they all lived patriotically ever after" documentaries. But the trail's there, in the structure of the document itself, in what got cut, in what got hidden, and in what grew from its silence. Because they weren't just rewriting a system, they were sent to fix the articles. What they built was the empire. Before we talk about what they built, we need to talk about what they broke. In 1787, the United States wasn't a nation the way we think of it today. There was no federal judge in a robe, no standing army parked on standby, no president with a pen and a drone fleet, and definitely no income tax pulling from your kid's future. The country was running on a very different playbook, a document called the Articles of Confederation. It was more like a treaty than a constitution. 13 states, recently freed from a king, now bound by a handshake agreement, cooperating, sort of, while still acting like independent countries. They printed their own currency, built their own militias, they even cut trade deals solo. And under those articles, there was one non-negotiable clause: no amendments unless all 13 states agreed. No exceptions. That wasn't a suggestion, that was the law. So when Congress gave the green light for a meeting in Philadelphia, they were crystal clear. The delegates were there for the sole and express purpose of fixing the articles, not rewriting them, not tossing them in the fireplace, just revisions. But the moment those delegates walked into Independence Hall, they slammed the doors, sealed the windows, swore a vow of silence, and threw the entire system in the trash. No vote, no permission, no legal authority to do so. They decided behind closed doors to rewrite an entirely new government from scratch. And here's the kicker. There was no reset clause in the articles, no legal off-ramp. If you wanted change, you needed every single state on board. Rhode Island didn't even show up. They saw what was coming and wanted no part of it. They knew the bigger states were gunning for more power, more control over currency, commerce, and taxation. And that missing seat made the entire convention illegal from the jump. They weren't the only ones who protested. Some of the actual delegates walked out. Luther Martin of Maryland stormed out halfway, calling it an abomination. Robert Yates and John Lansing Jr. left early and warned New York the convention had exceeded its mandate. Even George Mason, who helped write the Constitution, refused to sign it. He demanded a Bill of Rights and warned that too much power was being handed to the federal core. Let that sink in. Men who were literally in the room while it was being built walked out, refused to sign. And no one on the outside knew why. Because everything that happened inside was sealed. No transcripts, no press, no debates, no public insight. Windows nailed shut, doors guarded, delegates forbidden to speak. The Journal of the Convention, redacted. Later called the most remarkable suppression of public debate in American history. We only even know what happened thanks to James Madison's private notes. And he didn't publish them until 1840. That's 53 years later and 4 years after he died. So let's do the math. The American people lived under a government they didn't fully understand for over half a century. And then came the final twist, the ratification rule swap. Under the Articles, unanimous consent was required, but the new Constitution, it declared itself valid if just 9 states signed on. So where did that rule come from? Well, the same guys who wrote the document. They changed the rules to approve the rules they just wrote. That's not due process. That's legal inception. And yet, it worked. 9 states signed. The rest followed, and the United States was born. Not on consensus, not on law, but on urgency and fear and secrecy. They didn't just rewrite the rules. They swapped the whole scoreboard while the crowd wasn't looking. Most Americans grow up thinking the Founding Fathers were all on the same page, all in one room, all in agreement, Whig squad unity. They weren't, not even close. While some delegates were drafting the Constitution in lockdown mode, others were out warning the country what was really going down. And what they said back then? It doesn't sound like the 1700s. It sounds like this morning. These weren't fringe theorists hiding in the woods. They were lawyers, judges, farmers, combat veterans who'd bled for the idea of liberty. And when they saw the fine print on this new federal experiment, they didn't see balance. They saw something dressed up like democracy, but built like an empire. Let's start with Patrick Henry. You know him for one line, "Give me liberty or give me death." But when it came time to attend the Constitutional Convention, he skipped it outright. Said it flat, "I smell a rat." Once he read the draft, he didn't hold back. Said this new presidency smells like a throne. No term limits, commander-in-chief powers with no leash, solo veto power, war and diplomacy under one man's signature. He wasn't theorizing. He was calling his shot. And now, one person can launch drone strikes, install federal judges by the hundreds, push executive orders through without a vote, invoke emergencies to unlock powers the founders never wrote down. This wasn't some paranoid outburst. It was Henry's nightmare. And here we are. Now meet George Mason. He helped write the Constitution. But when it came time to sign it, he refused. No Bill of Rights, no deal. He warned, without explicit protections for speech, faith, due process, the government would eventually forget who it worked for. His quote, "There is no Declaration of Rights. The laws of the general government are to be paramount to the state bills of rights." Translation, if the feds say jump, the states won't even be allowed to ask why. Now, fast forward. Dissent is labeled dangerous. Tech companies flag your speech at the request of government agencies. State laws get overridden like potholes in DC. Mason saw it coming, and he walked away from the document he helped shape. Now let's talk Luther Martin. He was a Maryland delegate in the room, and he didn't like what he saw, so he left. In his letter back home, he unloaded, quote, "This system is calculated to annihilate the sovereignty of the states and to establish a government of men, not of laws." Annihilate the states, turn public office into personality rule, tax us into obedience, and bury the source of real power so deep, most citizens wouldn't even know where to look. That's not a prediction anymore. That's just a Tuesday. State budgets live off federal crumbs. Agencies you didn't vote for write half the rules you follow. In the courts, they're untouchable. Martin tried to pull the fire alarm, but nobody wanted to hear it. And then there's Sentinel. That was the pen name of Samuel Bryan, anti-federalist writer out of Pennsylvania. His essays didn't make it into school curriculums, but they should have. In Sentinel number 1, he drops this: the wealthy and ambitious have availed themselves of this flaw. He meant the Constitution and what it would become. He saw power stacking at the top, money steering policy, corporate handshakes shaping the future. He didn't call it dark money or lobbying. He just called it what it was: a slow motion takeover by the ambitious. Today, we call it super PACs, revolving doors between Congress and consulting gigs, billionaires writing policy with a wink and a donation. Sentinel didn't just criticize the system, he saw the bones beneath it. Now, pull it all together. These men, Patrick Henry, George Mason, Luther Martin, Samuel Bryan, they weren't rebels, they weren't bitter. They were watching something sacred slip out of the people's hands. And they said it plainly: a federal standing army, a permanent tax pipeline, an unelected judiciary with no expiration date, the collapse of state sovereignty, mass surveillance, a single executive with near monarchic power. That's what they warned, and that's exactly what we have. They weren't outvoted because they were wrong. They were outvoted because they were inconvenient. So the spotlight moved. Their letters went unread. Their speeches went missing. Their fears were paved over with marble statues and July 4th barbecues. But the truth, it never left. It's still right there, between the lines, right where they said it would be. Because maybe they didn't lose the debate. Maybe we just stopped listening. By 1787, the Constitution wasn't just a proposal, it was a bet, a behind-closed-doors rewrite of the government. No legal green light, no public vote, no consent. And the people writing it, they knew what they'd just done. If the country found out how it was made, game over. States could walk. The whole plan could tank before ink even dried. So they didn't send troops. They didn't beg. They did something way smarter. They launched a perception war. Three names led the charge: Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and John Jay. They wrote under one fake name, Publius, and dropped essays like political grenades into newspapers across the colonies. Their mission? Justify the rewrite, downplay the risks, and roast anyone who got in the way. We call them the Federalist Papers. Back then, they were just aggressive marketing. Papers weren't neutral. Most leaned one way or the other. So the Federalists carpet-bombed the friendly ones, page after page telling Americans, this new Constitution is the only thing keeping us from falling apart. No room for real debate. No fair platforming of dissent. Just full-blown saturation. And it worked. Their words got reprinted, spoken aloud in town halls, taught like scripture before the ink even dried. If you questioned the Constitution, you weren't cautious, you were dangerous, you were reckless, you were anti-American. The core tactic? Forced the choice into two boxes: ratify or collapse, conform or chaos. Hamilton spelled it out in Federalist Number 6. Refuse unity and we will get perpetual wars between states. In number 15, he called the current system imbecilic. In number 23, he practically hands the federal government a blank check in the name of national defense. It wasn't persuasion, it was linguistic blackmail. Another trick? Wrap it in red, white, and blue. The Constitution wasn't pitched as a new idea. It was framed as the final victory of the revolution. Support Washington, then you support the Constitution. Do you want liberty? Then sign on the dotted line. Love your country, then get in line. Never mind that some of the same men who fought that war, Mason, Henry, Bryan, were raising red flags. The message to the public was simple. Opposition equals division. Division equals weakness, and weakness means invasion. Federalist number 4, John Jay warns Europe's licking its chops. Number 25, Hamilton says we need a permanent army or we're toast. The irony? These same states had just kicked the British out without a constitution. But the fear play worked. Don't unite? The British come back. Delay? Spain or France will eat us alive. Hesitate? Lose it all. Does that sound familiar? Because it should. That playbook never got retired. Now here's where it really slides off the rails. The original Constitution, the one being pushed this hard, didn't even include a Bill of Rights. There were zero guaranteed protections for speech, faith, due process, search and seizure, jury trials. When the anti-federalists raised the issue, the federalists said, we'll add it later, just pass it now. Civil liberties as a future patch update, no guarantees, just vibes. Can you imagine that today? Sign here, we'll protect your rights in version 2.0. And by the time the Bill of Rights did get added, it was after the machinery had already bolted together. The taxing power, the supremacy clause, the federal courts, the muscle was in place. The Bill of Rights didn't build the foundation. It just tried to paint over the cracks. And when all else failed, the Federalists flipped the script on their critics. Madison called them agents of obstruction and discord. Hamilton painted them as manipulators out to deceive the public. It didn't matter that these were revolutionary heroes, war vets, civic leaders, founders in their own right. The moment they questioned the Constitution, they were cast as enemies of progress, stuck in the past, paranoid, or just flat out wrong. The public got the message loud and clear. If you're not with us, you're a problem. So if it's ever felt like the Constitution was universally embraced from day one, it's because the Federalists made sure it looked that way. They didn't just win the argument, they rigged the microphone and turned it all the way up. The Constitution was never supposed to be set in stone. Even its architects said it would evolve. But what they didn't mention was how much stretch they built into it. Elastic phrases, rubber definitions, words that could flex just enough to turn guardrails into on-ramps. And little by little, they did. What started as a handshake between 13 states morphed into a federal monolith with polite paperwork. Let's rewind to one of the first stretches, Alexander Hamilton's National Bank. Thomas Jefferson nearly choked. He said, "Show me where in the Constitution this is allowed." Hamilton shrugged, pointed to vague words in Article 1, necessary and proper. Boom. The elastic snapped, and suddenly, if something wasn't explicitly banned, maybe it was fair game. And just like that, the elastic clause was born. It wouldn't be the last time they pulled it either. Next up, the 1860s. The Civil War didn't just preserve the Union, it rewired it. Lincoln suspended habeas corpus. Federal troops occupied states. Washington began taxing income for the first time ever. And when the war dust settled, that little line in the Constitution, the Supremacy Clause, got weaponized. It now meant federal law stomped state law, period. Then came 1913, the financial mutation. Two things happened that year. The 16th Amendment gave DC permanent access to your paycheck, and Congress birthed the Federal Reserve, a central banking system with the power to print and choke money on command. Between the IRS and the Fed, Washington now controlled both your taxes and your inflation rate. From that moment on, money wasn't just currency, it was leverage. Now let's jump to the 1930s. The Great Depression hits. Enter the New Deal. FDR rolls out sweeping new federal programs, Social Security, mass work projects, regulation over banks and crops. And the justification? One warm, fuzzy phrase, general welfare. It's in the preamble, meant to inspire, not legislate. But suddenly, it was being used to build an entirely new tier of government control. And when the Supreme Court pushed back, Roosevelt threatened to pack the bench. The justices folded. And just like that, general welfare became a magic wand. And the next decade? Different label, same game. 1960s, the Great Society. Lyndon B. Johnson drops Medicare, Medicaid, public housing, and a federal Department of Education. All greenlit under a different clause, the Commerce Clause. Originally, it just let Congress regulate trade between states. But by the 60s, it was being used to regulate your dinner menu, your school lunch, and whether a small town business had enough parking spots. The logic? It affects commerce. We can regulate it. And what doesn't? Now fast forward again to 2001. 9/11 hits. Fear spikes. The Patriot Act rolls in like a tank. Wiretaps without warrants. Mass surveillance. Secret courts. Indefinite detentions. It was pitched as temporary. Emergency only. But none of it went away. Instead, it grew. Wrapped in flags, stamped as legal, backed by the same vague phrases, necessary, proper, secure. That's the slope. And now? Today we've got over 400 federal departments and agencies, an intelligence web nobody can diagram, bases in over 70 countries, $34 trillion in debt, and a surveillance network that watches your location, searches, purchases, voice, camera, and clicks. Programs like Prism pull your data straight from tech companies. X Keyscore tracks everything online, real time. Stellar Wind captures your emails and calls before you hit send. And every time someone asks why, the answer is the same. It's constitutional. Or worse, it's for your own good. This is what the anti-federalists saw coming. They weren't afraid of law. They were afraid of loopholes. Phrases like general welfare or commerce weren't flaws. They were tools. And once those tools existed, there was always a reason to use them. A crisis, an emergency, a new threat that demanded more reach, more power, more access. Every generation gave a little more and got a little less. Now, we're not just looking at a big government. We're looking at a borderless system, one that collects, classifies, and decides what's necessary without asking permission. It started as a document to protect freedom. What it became was the instruction manual for Leviathan. You don't have to guess if the anti-federalists were right. You can flip on the news, scroll your feed, open a browser. The stuff they feared? We're living it. Not as a theory, as headlines, court rulings, body cams, and leaked files. They weren't alarmists. They were early. Because once the ink dried, the machine didn't wait. It ran. Let's start with boots on the ground. Literally. The anti-federalists warned about a standing army used against civilians. People rolled their eyes. Until 1970, in Kent State University, a campus protest against the Vietnam War. The National Guard was called in, and they opened fire. No war zone, no enemy lines, just students in the grass. 4 dead, 9 wounded, all unarmed, all American. And this wasn't foreign policy. This was a warning shot at home. Patrick Henry called this word for word. Next, war without Congress. The Constitution is clear. Congress declares war. But when's the last time that happened? Here's a clue. It's older than most of your passwords. Vietnam? No. Iraq? Nope. Afghanistan? Negative. Libya, Syria, Somalia? All greenlit with legal acrobatics. In 1964, LBJ used the Gulf of Tonkin incident to launch full-scale war without a declaration. In 2001, Congress passed the AUMF, the Authorization for Use of Military Force. It gave George W. Bush a blank check to go after terror worldwide with no expiration date, no borders. It's still active today. One vote, endless war. Presidents now drone strike sovereign nations on Tuesdays and point to the Commander-in-Chief clause like it's a hall pass. This isn't how it was supposed to work. It's just how it does now. Now, let's talk surveillance. The anti-federalists said the government would eventually turn its gaze inward. And for a while, people called that paranoia. That is, until Edward Snowden dropped a flash drive. Turns out, they weren't watching terrorists. They were watching everyone. The NSA was running a full-spectrum digital dragnet. Phone logs, text threads, keystrokes, microphone access, location pings, even webcam feeds. Programs like Prism hoovered up your data straight from Google, Facebook, and Apple. XKeyscore let analysts search everything you've ever typed. Stellar Wind captured calls and emails without warrants, stored them, labeled them, and then analyzed them. All of it backed by secret courts, no oversight, no transparency, and according to the government, totally legal. Because somewhere, buried in some dusty clause, they found the wiggle room. The founders never imagined TikTok, but the anti-federalists, they understood mission creep. And then now the court. One of the biggest warnings was that an unelected judiciary, especially the Supreme Court, could become the most powerful force in American life. And yes, 9 people now decide if you can own a gun, if your healthcare stands, if your vote counts, what rights you have over your own body, and these justices aren't elected. They serve for life, and they don't answer to the people or the states. One ruling and every law under it collapses, even if that law was passed by millions of voters. This isn't checks and balances. It's black robes with veto pens. Now here's the one no one teaches in school, but every local official knows. States don't control their own budgets anymore. Why? Because most of the money comes from Washington, and federal dollars come with strings attached. You want highway funding? Raise the drinking age. You want school money? Teach what we tell you. You want disaster relief? Sign right here. If a state resists, they get cut off. This isn't cooperation, it's conditional survival. Back in 1787, Luther Martin said the feds would subdue the states by the power of the purse. Now, mayors, school boards, sheriffs, governors, they all toe the line or risk collapse. They're not obeying out of belief, they're obeying out of budget. Rural towns can't fix roads without EPA clearance. States can't manage their own forests without federal approval. Try to go your own way? The lawsuits fly in before the ink dries. Washington doesn't partner with the states. It owns them. Through legal codes, through funding formulas, through a web of agencies you'll never meet, but that still get a say in your life. And the kicker? Every single one of these outcomes, every single one, was mapped in advance. Not as fiction, as warnings. They weren't dismissed because they were wrong. They were dismissed because they were inconvenient. We didn't ignore them. We fulfilled them in slow motion. And now, here we are, living in the echo of what they tried to stop. The question now isn't, were they right? It's, what else did we shrug off? It was never just about rules on paper. No one rewrites the entire operating system unless they plan to run it. The Constitution wasn't just legal architecture. It was a handoff, a shift of power from the town square to the Capitol, from farmers to financiers. The anti-federalists didn't just question the framework, they questioned who built it, and, more importantly, who stood to gain. Because behind the public speeches and powdered wigs, there was a quiet deal forming. The founders may have signed it, but the money class bankrolled it. Start with the usual suspect, Alexander Hamilton. Genius? Sure. Combat vet? Yes. But he also had deep ties to New York banking elite. And when the Constitution passed, his wish list went live. The new federal government could now collect taxes, take on war debt, and most importantly, it could charter a national bank. Guess who just happened to have the blueprint ready? Hamilton got his central bank in 1791, and with it, a direct pipeline from wealthy creditors to national policy. Not in theory, in practice. This wasn't cleanup, it was a rollout. Now zoom out. After the war, the US was drowning in debt. Foreign loans, domestic bonds, some of it held by everyday patriots, but most in the hands of speculators, merchants, northern banking houses, even members of Congress. Under the Articles of Confederation, there was no national taxing power. States controlled their own purses, and some weren't paying up. So who needed stronger federal enforcement? Not the farmers, the financiers. They were sitting on IOUs and needed someone big enough to cash them. The Constitution gave them that enforcer. So it wasn't just about unity, it was about liquidity. Then there's the commercial elite. At the time, rural states like Georgia or the Carolinas had vividly different priorities than port-heavy hubs like New York or Boston. Urban elites wanted federal tariffs, central currency, infrastructure investments, a navy to protect trade overseas. The Articles didn't deliver that, so they backed the new Constitution like it was a venture deal. And what did they get? Tariffs that protected industry, shipping lanes and canals for coastal commerce, a northern economic boom while the rural South stayed agrarian and dependent. It was less about representation and more about revenue streams. That divide didn't start last week. It started right here. City versus country, coasts versus middle, policy versus people. Still sound like it was just about fixing the Articles? Now here's where it gets murky. National security. The Constitution was marketed with fear, foreign empires, insecure borders, rogue states. But fear is fuel, and that fuel powered the creation of something much bigger. An invisible scaffolding of federal authority. The CIA was born in the shadows. The NSA didn't exist until it did. The FBI started as a crime-fighting unit, but grew into a political force of its own. Each agency had a mandate. Then, each became its own orbit, answerable to no one but the executive branch. And all of it made possible by the elastic phrases baked into the Constitution. Necessary and proper. General welfare. Commander-in-chief. Legal Play-Doh for every emergency. Which brings us to the part no one wants to say out loud. Some people built this system and never planned to live under it. Originally, Congress was supposed to be a citizen body. You serve, you leave, you go back to the plow. Now, politics is a ladder. And DC is a closed circuit. No term limits, no budget caps. Lobbyists write the bills, and lawmakers rubber stamp them between cocktail fundraisers. They don't read the laws, they read the donations. And those 3,000-page mega bills? You think your rep is combing through every clause? Not a chance. It's pre-packaged legislation, drafted by corporations, passed by people who profit, and enforced on communities they don't even understand. Meanwhile, you get told to vote harder. It's not gridlock, it's design. Because once power is centralized, the fight isn't about left or right. It's about who gets the keys. And make no mistake, those keys were never meant for everyone. The Articles of Confederation were messy, but they were local, human-scaled. The Constitution? It was version 2, and version 2 came with shareholders. Let's pull back for a second, because if your stomach's turning, if you feel your jaw clenching, that's not a bad sign. It means you're still awake. This episode isn't about comforting anyone's worldview. Not mine, not yours. It's about putting the receipts on the table and letting the questions land where they land. And just so we're clear, I love this country. I wore the uniform. I still believe in what it can be. So no, this isn't an anti-constitution episode. It's not an anti-government episode. It's not about tearing anything down. It's about finally looking at what got built and asking, was the blueprint what we were told it was? Because if we can't talk about the foundation, what exactly are we building on top of it? Everything you've heard in this episode, every quote, every name, policy, and shift, didn't come from Reddit threads or whistleblower gossip. It came from primary source docs, founding era letters, declassified court opinions, surveillance programs the government admits exist, and textbooks that have gathered more dust than scrutiny. No filters, no AI tricks, no, trust me, bro, just history. You don't need to believe in a conspiracy, you just need to pay attention. And in fairness, not everyone agrees with a darker interpretation. Plenty of historians argue the founders weren't scheming, they were terrified. The articles were collapsing. States were fighting each other. The government couldn't raise an army. Debt was strangling the young republic. Foreign powers were circling. From that view, the Constitution wasn't a power grab, it was a life raft. And yes, some of those men genuinely believed that they were saving the country. They were imperfect, ambitious, sometimes arrogant, but not always malicious. And let's be honest, some federal power has done good. Civil rights legislation, food safety, public health, disaster response, highways, clean water, seatbelts. Not every law is oppression. Some were born from compassion. Others from sheer necessity. So it's not all evil, but it's also not all innocent. Because if we never question how power expands, we have no breaks when it's misused. That's the real line, the one that matters, the only one that matters. Truth isn't betrayal, it's what patriotism actually looks like. So ask yourself, which is more American, clapping for every decision made in the dark? Or flipping on the light no matter where it leads. The Constitution is powerful, but it's not sacred. It was written by humans who argued, compromised, and yes, made deals. It gave us something worth protecting, but if we don't understand how it's been stretched, we can't protect it when it tears. Loving this country doesn't mean reciting slogans. It means demanding truth, not to destroy the story, but to finally tell the real one. Because blind loyalty isn't patriotism, and silence isn't freedom. Truth is, even when it stings, especially when it stings. So what do you do with a truth like this? That the Constitution, the document we're told defines us, was written in secret, approved through fear, and sold through half promises. That the people who warned us saw it all coming, and no one listened. Do you burn the flag? No, of course not. You fold it tighter, because real patriotism has never been about defending power. It's been about defending people. The ones who bled for this land, not to empower a government, but to escape one. America didn't begin in marble halls. It began in blood, in snow-covered boots, in wooden shacks with no heat and no guarantee the cause would survive the winter. It began with people who said no to kings, even when that meant hunger, isolation, or worse, death. And those people didn't die for a surveillance state. They didn't die for alphabet agencies or a Supreme Court that rules by decree. They died for a chance, a whisper of something better, a system where power answers to people, not the other way around. And somewhere along the way, we got tired, we got comfortable, and we started confusing obedience with patriotism. But if history teaches us anything, it's this. Freedom doesn't come from governments. It comes in spite of them. It comes from farmers hiding muskets under floorboards, from journalists jailed for the stories they dared to print, from marchers beaten in the street because they refused to be silent, from whistleblowers in exile who gave up comfort for truth. It comes from people like you, people who ask questions, who read past the headlines, who say, wait, who benefits from this? This is what makes you American, not blind loyalty, but brave clarity. The Constitution is still here, but so is the federal machine. And maybe the real question isn't, can we fix it? Maybe it's, do we even remember what we were trying to build in the first place? Because this was never about government. It was about us. Maybe the Constitution was written in shadow, but the truth was always meant for the light. If this episode moved you, if it made you question something you thought you knew, if it reminded you that history isn't clean or easy or always noble, then share it. Because here's the reality. The algorithm will push a cat dancing in a banana suit to 11 million views. But a truth first investigation like this, it barely sees the light of day. So if you want more stories like this, if you want more deep dives, more documents, more nights where we just ask the questions no one else will, then consider joining the mission. You can support the show over at patreon.com/divergentfiles. We've got no agenda, just curiosity, integrity, and a relentless need to find the signal in the noise. Because if we don't tell these stories, no one will. Until next time, stay curious, keep questioning, because no matter what they tell you, the truth is still out there. These investigations are powered by those who believe truth still matters. Thank you to our Patreon supporters. Join the mission at patreon.com/divergentfiles.